From NPR News and WBUR, I'm Eric Westervelt.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. EPA Administrator Scott Pruitt is getting grilled by lawmakers on Capitol Hill today, facing tough questions about travel spending, allegations of ethics violations, giving huge raises to political appointees, renting a condo room from a lobbyist at rock-bottom prices. He was asked about installing a $43,000 soundproof phone booth in his office, which the Government Accountability Office concluded Monday violated federal law. Here's an exchange with Representative Diana Deggett from Colorado.
The EPA has the ability to impose penalties for this illegal activity. Will you or your staff be subject to these penalties, yes or no?
We are investigating this internally with appropriate individuals both here as well as Inspector General.
All right.
NPR national reporter Nathan Rott joins us now. Nathan, how did Scott Pruitt do? So many questions about spending and allegations of ethics violations.
Yeah, I mean, he didn't answer all the questions. I mean, in his opening statements, he mentioned accountability and how at a point, you know, the buck stops at him. And he did acknowledge that there has been, in his words, a, quote, learning process. But then he followed that by saying that he believes he has been accountable to taxpayers and the American public during his tenure, that he has nothing to hide. He characterized the long list of ethical lapses against him as he has done before, of being part of a larger plot to derail President Trump's deregulatory agenda. Democrats pressed him on specifics with a lot of, you know, yes-no questions that didn't draw a whole lot of yes-no answers. And there really wasn't anything too revelatory in the answers that he gave. He denied knowing the cost of that $43,000 phone booth at the EPA. He said he would not have signed off on it if he had known. And he said he did not know how big the pay raises were for some of his aides. He said ethics officials had approved his former housing in D.C. at a condo owned by those lobbyists. So there was a lot of deniability and a little bit of dismissiveness.
Well, some of the aides worked for Mr. Pruitt in Oklahoma, where he was attorney general. One of them, Sarah Greenwald, had a salary raised to $164,000 from $107,000. Another, Milan Hupp, was raised to $114,000 from $86,000. And you mentioned the soundproof booth. That was reportedly installed at $43,000 by the new head of member of his security detail, who it's been revealed in reporting worked for the tabloid publisher American Media. They published the National Enquirer. Of course, they're owned by a Trump friend and supporter. And this man's job in the 2016 campaign working for the National Enquirer was feeding stories back to the National Enquirer. Now he's in Scott Pruitt's office. He was asked about that as well. Was this largely about spending and ethics issues? Did this have anything to do with policy?
There was some policy. That was a common complaint amongst the Republicans, that Democrats did not want to talk about policy. They just wanted to come after Pruitt about these alleged ethical missteps. Republicans did bring up and praise Pruitt for some of his policy accomplishments or things that he's gotten going during his tenure. They talked about Superfunds. They talked about brownfields. They talked about his effort to repeal the Clean Power Plan, Waters of the U.S., many policy issues that they brought up. But the questioning, whenever it went back to a Democrat, certainly came back to these ethical questions.
Well, one thing that did come up a lot is the move by Pruitt this week to limit the science that can be used in writing agency regulations. Here's what he said about that.
It seems to me that it's common sense that as we do rulemaking at the agency, when we base it upon a record, scientific conclusions, that we should be able to see the data and methodology that actually cause those conclusions. Right. That just makes common sense to me. That's the only change we're making.
Nathan Rott, that's not how critics see it. Explain more about this proposed rule.
So it's a bit complicated, but essentially what it would do is it would seek to accomplish something that Republicans and industry have been after for a while. There have been many legislative efforts to get this going. It would require that any science or research that the EPA uses in making regulations be completely public. All of the information and the research needs to be open. So in practice, right, that sounds good, like you heard Pruitt just say, but a huge number of scientific organizations, public health groups have come out against the proposal. Basically, their main concerns are that by requiring everything to be made public, you'd be essentially saying that individuals who take part in like a public health study would need to have their private information publicized. So there's obviously some medical privacy questions there. There's also a requirement that the research be replicable, that it can be done again to prove the results. And that's problematic for research following, you know, something like a one-time event like the BP oil spill or the, you know, the fires in Northern California last year. Scientists could not feasibly replicate those scenarios to meet this requirement.
good note to end it on. Nathan Rott on NPR's National Desk, thank you.
Thank you.
To Korea now. The leaders of North and South Korea, Kim Jong-un and Moon Jae-in, will plant a ceremonial tree and inspect an honor guard together after Kim walks across the border into South Korea tomorrow. It'll be the first time a North Korean leader has been in the South since the fighting in the Korean War stopped in 1953. The summit will also set the stage for a meeting later this year between Kim and President Trump. Joining us now is NPR's Anthony Kuhn, who's in Seoul for tomorrow's meeting. Anthony, thanks for coming in.
You bet, Eric.
Tomorrow's meeting has a lot of symbolism, maybe even powerful symbolism, but there's got to be more to it, yeah? Well, what are the stakes here?
The stakes are very high. This is the third meeting ever between the leaders of the two Koreas. 2000 and 2007 were the first two. This time, what's really different, of course, is that North Korea has a much more credible nuclear arsenal, and the threat of war is clearly greater. On the other hand, the main issues of peace treaty and denuclearization cannot be totally resolved without U.S. participation and probably eventually Chinese participation. But I think there is some suspense here, and that is that nobody really knows what Kim Jong-un's intentions are, what the upshot of this whole summit is going to be. And experts' predictions, from what I'm hearing right here, are all over the map. Some people who are optimistic see this as, you know, the end of North Korea's days as a rogue regime, that it's changing its ways, that the summit could, you know, change the shape of Northeast Asia. Pessimists think it's basically just another con game, another chance for the Kim Jong-un regime to buy more time, to hang on for longer and make some more nukes.
Is there any pressure on President Moon to come away from this meeting with something concrete, not just optics and symbolism, when it comes to Kim's nuclear program?
Absolutely. Moon Jae-in has been advocating engagement with North Korea all along. What's more, he says that North Korea is willing to go ahead with complete nuclear disarmament, not just freezing, but complete nuclear disarmament. Some people really do not disagree with him. And if it turns out that if he's wrong, he's really going to be hung out to dry. It's going to look terrible. At the same time, there are other issues here. Denuclearization is, you know, clearly key. But also, inter-Korean relations are important because you've got these two huge armies lined up along the demilitarized zone. You've got families that have been broken up for more than half a century. So what happens between the two Koreas about mending their fences is important for a lot of people's lives.
Anthony, there'll be a meeting and a banquet, as I understand it. It seems pretty choreographed. Is there any chance at all there'll be a press conference between these two, or something more than just a joint statement? What's going to happen here?
I don't think there's going to be a press conference. There should be some sort of declaration in which they lay out the progress they made that should come towards the end of the day of talks. And if things go well, they'll put forth what they call a Panmunjom declaration. And Panmunjom is the name of the truce village along the demilitarized zone where the armistice was signed in 1953. If things do not go well in the talks, then there'll be some sort of low-key announcement in the meeting. But some parts of this have been sort of nailed down in advance, particularly the inter-Korean stuff. But the real meat, the real crucial stuff about denuclearization, they have not been able to reach an agreement on in advance. So it'll all come down to these two men, Kim Jong-un and Moon Jae-in, to decide at the summit.
Do we know anything about what the people of North Korea will see or hear about this meeting?
Well, they sure know it's happening, and Kim Jong-un has already declared victory in the country's quest to become a nuclear power. And they were also told recently that now that they have this nuclear deterrent, the country can shift its focus to developing its economy and raising people's living standards, and you can bet that's welcome. So expectations in the North Korean public have surely been raised.
Anthony, you're based in China. And China is North Korea's closest ally. Talk about Beijing's perspective on this meeting between Kim and Moon, and what's at stake for them.
Well, publicly, of course, they're very happy this is happening because they've been calling for negotiations all along, particularly between Pyongyang and Washington, but also with Pyongyang and Seoul. Officially, Beijing believes that the only way to resolve this is for North Korea to follow China's example, and that means begin market-oriented reforms and open to the outside world, to outside investment. Privately, they're a bit nervous about being left out of all this summitry. That the U.S. and North Korea could eventually cut a deal, which puts them at some sort of disadvantage. So Beijing has, as a result, been stepping up its diplomatic game. They invited Kim Jong-un for his first ever visit to the country last month, and they've been letting it be known that China must be at the table for any major deal that reshapes the region, and that China's national interests have got to be respected.
Anthony Kuhn is NPR's Beijing correspondent. He's speaking with us from Seoul. Anthony, thank you.
You're welcome, Aaron.
A 40-year search for a serial killer and rapist in California is over. Yesterday, police said they arrested a former police officer who allegedly killed 12 people and raped dozens across the state in the 1970s and 80s. The suspect was dubbed the Golden State Killer. And a warning, this story may be disturbing to some listeners. From member station KQED, Alex Emsley reports.
In the 1970s, Joseph James D'Angelo worked as a police officer in a small California town. In 1976, he got a job with a police department north of Sacramento. And at about the same time, a man in a ski mask began breaking into homes in the area, raping women, sometimes with their partners tied up nearby.
Essentially, somebody's wife being raped in their home while their husband is home and unable to do anything about it.
Sacramento Sheriff Sergeant Paul Belli discussed the case 2 years ago when his department teamed up with the FBI and other agencies throughout the state.
That can only be described to me as somebody who's wanting to develop that terror and create that type of fear.
At the time, the FBI also released audio of a 1977 phone call believed to have been made by the suspect. He breathes heavily, then tells a woman, "Gonna kill you," repeatedly, before starting to curse at her. Belli says Brian and Katie Maggiore came upon the suspect while they were out for a walk in Sacramento in early 1978.
He was not afraid to kill rather than be discovered.
The couple was shot down as they ran away. D'Angelo was fired from his police job in 1979 after he was charged with shoplifting a hammer and dog repellent. By then, the suspect known as the East Area Rapist had widened his circle of crimes beyond Sacramento into the San Francisco Bay Area. But then the crimes suddenly appeared to stop. Actually, they moved south. In late 1979, a killer dubbed the original Night Stalker started breaking into homes in Southern California, killing more couples.
They were brutal attacks, sexually assaulting in the same way with the male subject there, and then very often bludgeoning both of them to death.
Joseph James D'Angelo, who's now 72 years old, has been charged with 4 counts of murder so far, but authorities expect to bring many more charges.
51 rapes and 12 murders.
Bruce Harrington's brother and sister-in-law are among those who were killed.
It is time for all victims to grieve and to take measure one last time, to bring closure to the anguish that we've all suffered for the last 40-some-odd years.
The man known as the East Area Rapist, the original Night Stalker, the Golden State Killer, was arrested on Tuesday in a suburb of the state capital. District Attorney Anne Marie Schubert.
We found the needle in the haystack, and it was right here in Sacramento.
It was a break in the past week that led to a match for a suspect police had sought for over 40 years, a case which came back into the spotlight a few weeks ago with the publication of a book about the crimes by the late Michelle McNamara. Prosecutors throughout the state are putting more cases together and determining where D'Angelo will eventually face trial. For Here and Now, I'm Alex Emsley in San Francisco.
And if author Michelle McNamara was still alive, she'd no doubt be writing the epilogue to her mesmerizing book about the Golden State Killer, I'll Be Gone in the Dark. When Michelle died suddenly in 2016, her husband, the comedian Patton Oswalt, made sure the book was published. We spoke in March on the book tour.
I hope something helps to break. That's what we're all hoping. everyone that's obsessed with this guy. We're all hoping to bring him to justice.
And Michelle will no doubt have been in some way a part of that.
Yes. Oh, she definitely. I mean, she named him. She named him the Golden State Killer. That hopefully puts more light and focus on him.
And police are now saying it did. Patton brought in Michelle's longtime researcher, Paul Haynes, and the investigative reporter, Billy Jensen, to finish the book she started. Let's bring Billy in now. And again, a warning, some of this may be tough to listen to. But Billy, your thoughts when you first heard this news?
It's been a whirlwind. You know, we were all in Chicago for the book tour, and we were there with Gillian Flynn, Paul Haynes, and Patton and myself.
Gillian Flynn, the crime writer. And
exactly.
You were talking about this book and the hope that he would be caught.
Right. And we were, you know, somebody had talked to us and said, you know, the question came, do you think he'll ever be caught? And the question went to me and I said, absolutely, he's going to be caught. Mm-hmm. And they said, why? I said, well, because we have his DNA. It's not like the Zodiac Killer or anything like that. We do have his DNA. And mm-hmm. little did I know that they were probably filing the paperwork right then yeah. and outside of his door waiting for him to come out and nab him at yeah. that very moment.
Right.
So, you know, the news is not it was a surprise of how quick it was. Usually there's a ramp up, but we didn't have that ramp up. It happened so quickly. It really happened within 6 days.
Right.
Even, you know, obviously they weren't talking to the media and they wanted to keep everything close to the vest. But.
Well, you and others have been tweeting and texting with Patton. He also has been texting us. I guess you both have been talking about feeling like you're dreaming.
Yeah, I started writing everything down because I really did question my consciousness and whether I was actually dreaming or not, because it just all seemed so very weird.
Well, talk about Michelle. She became involved in crime reporting when she was a little girl, and a young woman was killed in her neighborhood, and she went and picked up shards of the girl's Walkman, you know, even then, getting things from a crime scene that others had overlooked. She became, as an adult, part of an online community that flooded message boards trying to crowdsource, solve cold cases, highly respected by law enforcement. What did she think about the killer? Who did, you know, what was the profile she had?
She definitely thought this wasn't a raving lunatic. This was somebody that was very meticulous. This was going to be a member of the community that you weren't necessarily completely got a warm feeling from, but he was there and he would go to events and he wasn't hiding in his house or anything like that.
Yeah.
You know, she did think that he probably, you know, very well might have worked in construction. She definitely thought he might have tried to have been a police officer at some point, which was actually the case. It turns out he was a police officer. And we all thought that he probably had at least had a scanner because he had known where the police patrols were going to be and yeah. things like that.
Look, when she died at 46 in 2016, she had this 4,000-page thumb drive that she got of police reports. She writes, "My eyes were stripped by computer glare and as devoid of moisture as if they'd been vacuumed clean by an airplane toilet." She could write. But she was trusted by survivors, by family of those who didn't survive, by law enforcement. And she doesn't spare us the details in the book. You know, someone can write off rape as rough sex until you read her descriptions. Couples bound, naked, the man made to get on all four with the family china on his back. He's told if he spills one thing while his wife is being brutally attacked, she will be killed. A neighbor glances outside, sees a naked man bound hand and foot hopping out his front door. The neighbor can't figure this out and then realizes it's her neighbor trying to escape. You know, this capture is exciting, but behind it is horror.
Yeah, and that's the thing that we have to remember is the victims. And, you know, she had said that, and she wrote this in the book, that his power evaporates the moment we know him. And we've been chasing him for so long, and he had power over all of us and certainly had power over Michelle and power over the investigators. And now he's got no power anymore. He's mm-hmm. done. Like Bruce Harrington said yesterday, he's history, you know, the brother of one of the victims. He's history. And, you know, we don't need to talk about him anymore. We need to, you know, certainly look into him. And the only reason to talk to him really is to make sure that he does stay behind bars or possibly gets the death penalty. And also what other crimes he might have committed, because that's my biggest question.
Well, that I was going to ask you your others, but we should say, of course, he hasn't, you know, been tried yet. But you're right. Michelle wrote, "There's a scream permanently lodged in my throat now." This took such a toll on her that once Patton came home late, she pounced up and grabbed a lamp and tried to hit him.
Yeah.
She was taking anti-anxiety medication when she suddenly died. She had an undiagnosed condition as well. So the toll that it took was amazing. But what were the other questions? Yes, other crimes. But what other questions do you have?
You know, there's some of the parlor game type of questions of people that know the case. Was that the his homework that he dropped at one of the crime scenes or outside one of the crime scenes? You know, those sort of things like that. Where did you come up with the plates idea? But really what I want to know is, A, why, obviously, but more importantly, who else did you do this to? Because I have a feeling that there are a lot of other victims out there, particularly maybe not necessarily murders, but particularly sexual assaults. He did ramp up. You know, he might have been in one jurisdiction where they weren't doing rape kits. Yeah. So there's a lot of timelines that need to be built right now and a lot of archives that need to be gone through.
Quick question. Michelle was trusted and beloved by some of the law enforcement that had worked on this for decades. She wrote that they felt so close to this guy after years. They thought if they passed him in a mall, they would be able to smell him, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Like a bloodhound. Have you had a chance to talk to any of them?
Yeah, a couple of them. You know, they're excited. I wish they would have gotten a chance to speak at the press conference. You know, at the press conference, we really just heard from
Corinne.
Their bosses and the sort of politicians. We didn't get to hear from the investigators, the guys in the trenches. And, you know, they're excited, but they also got a lot of work to do and they want to fill in all the gaps. So, you know, the work is not done.
And I imagine the nightmares don't go away.
Certainly for the victims, no.
Yeah. Billy Jensen, investigative journalist who helped finish the book I'll Be Gone in the Dark, started by Michelle McNamara, Patton Oswalt's late wife. Billy, thank you.
Thank you so much.
And again, if this is the Golden State Killer, one of the questions Michelle had was, if he indeed stopped, why did he stop? She and police speculated it's because much of the spree was staking out homes, climbing through windows, vaulting over fences, casing bedrooms long before attacks, and that maybe he just became too old.
One of the country's biggest automakers is making a big bet on trucks and SUVs. Ford announced yesterday it's discontinuing U.S. production of its smaller cars, like the Ford Fusion and the Focus. Ford says that by 2020, almost 90% of U.S. sales will be trucks, SUVs, and commercial vehicles. Robin Farzad hosts Full Disclosure on NPR One. Welcome, Robin.
Eric, how are you, sir?
I'm good, thank you. So now I kind of know why there's so many truck ads on TV. I mean, this sounds like a major shift for Ford. What's behind it?
It's both Ford and disruption hitting the entire industry. Look, don't forget that Ford managed to avoid restructuring and bankruptcy. It's already been a decade ago, and so it took its lumps the hard way. It wasn't able to just jettison a lot of the costs that GM was able to offload. And at the same time, over the past 5 years especially, the disruption that's hit the industry. Customers want different kinds of cars. You need to have a strategy for autonomous, for hybrids, for electrics, you know, in the wake of Tesla. Even subscription services for cars. Those millennials just aren't buying them as much as they should. But if you're Ford, you're also under intense pressure to show Wall Street a consistent profit, which has been elusive.
So were these smaller cars simply not selling well? And the second part, does this mean job cuts at some Ford factories?
Yeah, I mean, look, this is the trend across the industry. The sedan just seems to be going the way of the station wagons of my childhood. I mean, speaking of which, I remember when the Ford Taurus, you know, when it hit in the mid-early 80s was like the pinnacle of innovation.
How about those ones with the paneling on the side?
With the paneling, you know? And just fewer customers are buying them. The price competition is intense. Toyota, you know, with its Camry, just dominates that category. And if you're Ford, you're hoping to avoid layoffs and instead retool these factories to do more crossovers and SUVs and light trucks.
Are other automakers following them, focusing more on trucks and crossovers?
You're seeing that with GM. You're seeing that. Look, we've talked about Subaru in the past. The Toyota Highlander sells hot. I mean, GM cannot make enough Tahoes and Suburbans and Cadillac SUVs. So this has become a big selling point. But as we know in the past, it comes with its own peril if you overweigh your exposure to SUVs and light trucks.
Well, and isn't it risky in other ways as well when it comes to the price of oil and gas? Talk about that.
Yeah, I mean, you're clearly betting that the world isn't going to revisit $4 gas and that ravaged the industry and the economy 10 years ago. But, you know, memories are short and Wall Street is very quarterly in its thinking. Of course, you know, you could be Elon Musk and Tesla. Imagine if, you know, his $35,000 all-electric sedan becomes the model to have in 5 or 10 years. Where does that leave Ford?
Well, speaking of, you know, electric cars, I mean, does this push you know, accelerate the push toward trucks and SUVs in the U.S. What does it mean for the future of electric?
Gosh, isn't that like the holy grail? Could you imagine if you get like a Subaru Outback or a gigantic SUV that has, you know, you just plug that baby in and get 300 miles on it? But it's harder with range anxiety, battery technology, and you have to churn out hundreds of thousands of these cars, you know, to scale a learning curve and bring down costs to make a profit. So Ford is a massive company, 200,000 employees all over the world. It's not going to be able to just flip on a switch overnight and become a master of electric. So there's a lot of peril in this decision.
Robin Farzad hosts Full Disclosure on NPR One. Thanks so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Have you ever been inexplicably obsessed? Well, our next guest has insight. In a new book, the Christian Science Monitor calls one of the most peculiar and memorable you're ever likely to read about a crime. It's about feathers, the brilliant plumes that caught the eye of a 19th century researcher named A.R. Wallace, who came up with the same theory of evolution Charles Darwin did at the same time. And it's about the feathers that adorned hats that became such a sensation they wiped out bird populations, which today are again endangered because a group of fanatics are willing to pay top dollar for rare feathers to tie fishing lures for art. Which is why, in 2009, Edwin Rist, an American child prodigy flautist at the Royal Academy of Music and a star in the world of fly tying, broke into a British Museum of Natural History and stole hundreds of Victorian-era feathered bird skins. The book is called The Feather Thief, Beauty, Obsession, and the Natural History Heist of the Century. The author is Kirk Johnson, a former U.S. aid worker in Iraq, who we came to know in the early days of the Iraq War because of his obsession back then, helping Iraqi translators and fixers get to safety in the U.S. Kirk, welcome back, and what a book.
Thank you for having me.
And let's remind people who you are. You were nearly killed in a fall from a hotel balcony in Iraq. And you're laughing, but it's just amazing. In the early days of the war, you suffered from post-traumatic stress syndrome after your time as an aid worker in Fallujah. And after you decided that you just had become too obsessed with trying to get Iraqis out, you were on a fly fishing trip to sort of calm your nerves. Talk about, you know, this rabbit hole you went down, what you learned.
While I was on a river, my guide in New Mexico mentioned this thing about a museum heist, and he told me that a young kid named Edwin Rist had just broken into the British Museum. And when I first heard about it, it all seemed so strange as to be unbelievable. I mean, he said that the kid had stolen these birds in order for the feathers, which he would pluck and use for this sort of arcane Victorian art of salmon fly tying. And that he was hailed as the future of fly tying by this, what I kind of tongue-in-cheek call the feather underground. Mm-hmm. And the thing to know about salmon fly tying, which is very different from trout, is that salmon flies are just artistic, extravagant, aesthetic creations. They're rarely used to actually catch salmon. It's just mostly grown men following 150-year-old recipes, they're called, that employ feathers from a dozen different species of birds from every forest and rainforest and jungle throughout the world. And they're really beautiful, stunning things, but this is mainly an art form. You could just as easily catch salmon with a tuft of dog fur tied to a hook. There's no earthly reason why a salmon in Scotland should be attracted to a feather from a bird of paradise and from the highlands of New Guinea.
Well, let's back up a second. You just mentioned birds of paradise. We mentioned in the introduction the researcher A.R. Wallace, who was one of the first to see these incredible, fantastical birds. He brings them back to Britain. They were protected through two world wars. The birds were stuffed. They were to be used for research. They become part of a hat craze at one point. Tell us a little bit more about what we're talking about, what kind of feathers we're talking about.
These have the most strangely beautiful feathers you can imagine. Imagine a thin wire coming out of a bird's tail, and at the very end of that wire is an emerald, iridescent, coin-shaped coil of feathers. That's how the king bird of paradise attracts its mate. It stands in a tree and kind of wobbles these coin-shaped plumes back and forth. And Wallace, who you mentioned, in the 1850s, went to impossible lengths over an 8-year expedition throughout the Malay archipelago and gathered tens of thousands of these birds and beetles and other specimens. And these specimens have been safeguarded and stored in the British Museum for generations. These are not, just so people understand, these are not what you see when you walk into the public display of a museum where the birds have their wings outstretched. These are study specimens, they're called, and they have been used for countless scientific breakthroughs and insights. I mean, many of them were collected before the word scientist was even coined.
Yeah. So back to Edwin Rist, who breaks into this museum with a suitcase, stuffs over 200 of these birds in there, and begins selling them online. I mean, you go to great detective work to find some of these postings. You go into this online community. Some people had purchased these. Edwin Rist was not ever sent to jail, even though he was tried. He was found and tried. He used an Asperger's defense. He got off, and you start trying to find where some of the missing skins, they're called, of these birds still are.
Because this was such an embarrassment for the Brits, I think they were content to just call it a case closed, except about a third of these birds, which are worth about $1 million, were never found. And so I felt an obligation to go out and try to hunt these missing birds down because a huge hole had been blown open in the scientific record. I mean, that's one thing that you have to understand. These birds hold answers to questions that scientists haven't even thought to ask yet. And by stealing them, he has, in the words of the director of science for the British Museum, this was a catastrophic theft from humanity. And I felt that, okay, well, if no one's looking for these things, well, I'm just going to go find these things myself. And yeah,
you tracked down quite a few of them. There were 22 still missing. And by the way, Edwin Rist's father also went out and tried to get the community to give some of these skins back. But what did Edwin and some of these other fly tyers tell you in response to that question of yours, you know, theft from humanity, from research, from science?
Well, when I first started poking around and sort of improbably found myself at the International Fly Tying Symposium at the Doubletree Hotel in Somerset, New Jersey, I asked one fly tyer, you know, where are the missing skins? Like, did you buy any of them? And he looked at me. He was in the middle of tying a fly, and he kind of fixed this glare at me, and he said, I don't think you want to write that story. I don't think you should write this book. And I asked him why, and he goes, well, we're a tight-knit community, and you do not want to mess with us. They have a pretty large moral blind spot. They all cherish these feathers, and they feel that they have a right to them because of their passion for fly tying. And many of them are implicated in this because they bought from the feather thief himself. Mm. In speaking with Edwin, he had a pretty self-serving, I guess, for lack of a better term, ignorance about all of this. He told me that, you know, there's no more science that's being done on these birds, that after 100 years, you can't extract any DNA from them, which is, of course,
not true.
Ridiculous. Yeah. Mm. I was animated by a feeling that something really wrong happened here and no one was trying to fix it.
Well, Kirk Johnson, as a reader, we couldn't also help but notice that you became as obsessed as the feather seekers. And I found myself thinking, boy, Kirk thought he'd kind of give himself a break and move away from the Iraqis that he was trying to bring back because of the injustice there. And you run right into it again.
And I really thought that this would just be kind of a fun little side project. But you're right. After several years, I realized that I had somehow hitched myself to another unending problem in that almost everywhere I go, for example, I was just at the Los Angeles Natural History Museum getting a tour there. And while I was there, the ornithologist brought me over to a display cabinet and kind of quietly gestured at the framing of the cabinet and showed me the crowbar marks where a thief had broken into their collection. As quirky as this story must sound, in the end, this is a story about human obsession and where it drives us and the kind of rationalizations that it allows us to make because we want something and we think it's pretty or we think it's valuable. And so, yeah, it is a strange thing that a young man scaled a museum wall and, you know, bashed his way in and stole all of these birds. but it's also not that uncommon.
Yeah. Well, and we should say that there are members of the fly tying community who have been trying to switch to sustainable fly ties. They're fighting the tide, but they are there. Kirk Johnson, the book is The Feather Thief. Kirk formerly ran the List Project, the nonprofit he founded to help Iraqi translators and fixers get to safety in the U.S. Kirk, thank you so much. Lots of work in here, an incredible story. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me, Robin.
Oh, and one last note. When Kirk spoke with the feather thief, Edwin Rist, he said he showed no sign of Asperger's, and Edwin told Kirk he adopted some mannerisms for his trial. What were you wearing? That's the humiliating question often asked of a woman after she's been assaulted, as if to say her clothes might have been the cause. Well, an art exhibit confronts that thinking head on. It's called What Were You Wearing? And it's making the rounds at college campuses. Right now it's at the University of Florida. Earlier it was at the University of Kansas, where Jennifer Brockman is the director of the school's Sexual Assault Prevention and Education Center. She was also co-creator of this project while at the University of Arkansas in 2013. It's based on a poem we're going to hear about. Jen, you basically ask women on campus to tell you stories about their assault and the clothing they were wearing. Tell us more.
So we actually met with survivors and interviewed them and asked for their permission to recreate the outfits that they were wearing during their assault. Initially, we gathered about 18 stories from survivors, and then we take those and we recreate the stories, outfits with the stories. So these are not the actual clothes. And now over the years, the installation has grown to over 52 stories that have been donated by survivors. There is a program in India called Blank Noise, and that activist actually does create or collect the clothing of the survivor.
Okay. So you recreate the outfits given the descriptions you get, and it was inspired by a poem by Mary Simmerling. I have it pulled up here, What I Was Wearing. She writes, was this, from the top, a white T-shirt, cotton, short-sleeved and round at the neck, tucked into a jean skirt, also cotton, ending just above the knees, belted at the top. She goes on to describe what she was wearing, and she says, my answer seems flat somehow, given the rest of the details of that night, during which at some point I was raped. I mean, she seems to be saying that people who are questioning her, whether it's law enforcement or other people, what, want to hear that maybe there was something she was wearing so that it wouldn't happen to them?
Correct. So we feel like that most times this question is not asked from a place of malice. It's asked from a place of fear by those who love and care about us, that if they can figure out what was the item of clothes that somehow left us vulnerable, that all they have to do is avoid that item and they will never be in this place that we are sitting in now. Yeah. So it comes from that place of fear, but the results of it for survivors can be devastating.
Yeah. Mary Simmerling ends her poem writing, if only it were so simple, if only we could end rape by simply changing clothes. I remember also what he was wearing that night, even though it's true, no one's ever asked. So now these women are telling you about their assaults, their rapes, and you're recreating the clothing, and we'll have pictures at hereandnow.org. It's quite powerful. There's sort of a sheet background, and the clothing is laid out on it, and you could have coveralls and shorts and T-shirts. What has it done for the women who've participated by describing their clothing?
So the interesting thing is it's survivors of all gender identities, folks who identify as men, women, trans, non-gender binary, gender fluid. All of those spaces are represented within the project because sexual violence impacts folks of all gender identities. The space that we hear that has provided for them through this is a sense of almost a catalyst for healing. The idea that they can put this out, a space that they were so vulnerable and that was held over them, that somehow their clothing was to blame, and to be able to see that represented, have people go through and say, I have that same outfit. I wore that last week. That's so normal. This is really creating a nice space for survivors to feel validated and to feel honored.
Well, because maybe it was you who said this, others have spoken of this, that experience gets woven into the material of their clothing. It was the most intimate thing they had while this was happening. But it's not about shedding their own clothing. It's about what? Shedding their guilt?
It is. So, yeah, we talk about it as the violence is woven into the fabric. And it isn't about that idea of just removing the clothes, because as Mary pointed out, wouldn't that be so simple? But it's really walking away from that question and asking ourselves as the bystanders, as the loved ones, why do I have to ask that question in the first place? Yeah. What is it about society and about culture that leads me to feel like there's an answer at the end of this when there isn't?
Yeah. And some of the women who've participated have said things like, yes, I was wearing those coveralls that are, you know, pinned up there on that white sheet, and I haven't worn coveralls since. So maybe it's about reclaiming clothing, too.
It definitely is. We have a current story that was donated by a Kansas student talking about the color blue. Every time that they were assaulted, they were wearing a blue T-shirt. And they talk about how that was their favorite color, and they refused to stop wearing it. They refused to give that power to the person who harmed them.
Yeah. Are you getting more interest because we're in a Me Too moment?
I think that we are. So the very first project went up in 2014 and really hadn't had a lot of coverage. Mary and I hosted it within the Midwest. And we put it up in September 2017 on Kansas. It was on the heels of the Cosby trial, in the middle of the Weinstein. It was about a week before the Me Too hashtag. And since September, we've received 237 requests from six continents to host this installation.
That's Jen Brockman. The installation is What Were You Wearing? Replications of Clothing Women Were Wearing When They Were Sexually Assaulted or Raped. It's an awareness project. We'll have more of their thoughts about what can be done for victims of sexual assault at hearandnow.org, along with pictures of the installation. Jen, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
And I'm Eric Westervelt. You're listening to Here and Now.